This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about the weather. From wind to heat to rain, we've had a lively spring here in Wisconsin. A meteorologist tells us why the weather's been rapidly changing and what we can expect next. Now, Israeli and Palestinian authorities are both investigating how Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh was shot and killed last week while covering an Israeli military raid in the West Bank. Israeli police later attacked mourners in her funeral procession, claiming they provoked the violence. Officials from Israel's prominent allies in the European Union and U.S. have condemned that attack as tensions in the region remain high. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the killing of Abu Akleh and the response from Israel, from Palestinian authorities, and from the U.S.? What questions do you have about what's going on there now? What do you think of the U.S. role in the region and the U.S. relationship with Israel? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Stephen David is a professor of international relations and director of undergraduate studies for the Department of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University. Stephen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So what do you make of the international response so far to the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh?
Well, I think the outrage is appropriate. I mean, there are a lot of questions we need to have answered. Most obvious is who actually killed Shireen Abu Akleh. Was it the Israelis? Was it the Palestinians? And why did Israel react so violently to the funeral procession? I mean, the Israelis have said it had to do with the mourners trying to take the hearse, take the coffin away from the hearse. And there are arguments back and forth. But certainly the images, the optics are awful. It shows Israeli security personnel attacking the pallbearers and others in the procession. And so Israel has a lot to answer for in this.
The Biden administration has condemned that violence at the funeral in particular and called for an investigation, more investigations into the killing. Here's Press Secretary Jen Psaki speaking on Thursday.
This is a day where we should all be marking, including everyone there, the memory of a remarkable journalist who lost her life. With the disturbing footage from the funeral procession today in Jerusalem, we regret the intrusion into what should have been a peaceful procession. We've urged respect for the funeral procession, the mourners, and the family at this sensitive time. We're also in close touch with Israeli and Palestinian authorities, have been and obviously will continue to be, especially given the images we've seen today. We're not currently involved in any of the investigation, but we are working to bridge cooperation and available to provide assistance as needed.
How big a role, Stephen, does the U.S. have here? How big a role should it have in a follow-up and investigation here?
Well, I think America needs to have a central role in this. There's a lot of concern and suspicion that the Israelis will not do a fair and appropriate job, whether that's justified or not. That perception is out there. And the United States needs to hold the Israelis' feet to the fire and say, what went on here? What responsibility do you guys have for this? How was this allowed to happen, both the killing and the aftermath? And I suspect the diplomatic tone of what you just read is not being reflected in what is being said behind the scenes. I think America is saying to Israel, you know, we have your back. We're always there for you. Don't hang us out to dry on this. You've got to do a thorough and fair and honest investigation. And if there were mistakes made, people have to be punished.
Talking to Stephen David from Johns Hopkins University about the killing of a Palestinian-American journalist in the West Bank. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've been following that story, your thoughts and questions, wider questions or concerns about the U.S. role in Israel, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Stephen, I want to get a little wider perspective here. I think with all the news of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, our attention in the U.S. to Israel and the Palestinians may not be tightly focused in recent months. What's been going on there that led to this kind of Israeli military raid in the West Bank in the first place?
Well, there have been a spate of terrorist incidents against Israeli citizens over the past few months. I believe 19 Israelis were killed, 30 Palestinians were also killed. But the Israelis who were killed overwhelmingly were simply civilians, again, going about their business. This raid in Jenin, in the West Bank, was done in an effort to apprehend some of those terrorists who launched attacks in Israel. So tensions have been higher between Israelis and Palestinians than they have been in years. Part of this reflects ongoing disputes in Jerusalem over the Temple Mount, which both the Israelis and Palestinians see as the holiest parts of their religion, and the ongoing dispute with Israel settlements increasing and Palestinians being frustrated about lack of progress on developing their own state.
Can you talk about the status of the West Bank? It can be confusing because there are Palestinian authorities who are investigating things like this shooting. There is also an Israeli military presence. It is ambiguous, it seems like.
It is confusing. I mean, the West Bank is that area that Israel seized in the 1967 war. So we're talking about, you know, well over 50 years ago. And Israel and the Palestinians share governance over the West Bank, with the Palestinians having fairly exclusive control over the major population areas, with the Israelis having relatively exclusive control over the Israeli settlements and much of the land that connects them. So overall, in terms of the bottom line, it's the Israeli military that controls what goes on within the West Bank, despite the presence of the Palestinian Authority. That said, the investigation into the murder of Shireen Abu Akleh is at least being done initially by the Palestinian Authority, the governing body that the Palestinians have that controls, again, their population centers. Israel has asked for a joint investigation of what happened, and the Palestinians have refused. We don't know now exactly what kind of investigation the Palestinian Authority will pursue. Of special significance is the bullet that killed Shireen Abu Akleh. That bullet has been recovered, and presumably it has markings which would indicate the gun from which it was fired. And that would go a long way in determining just who was responsible for her killing. But the Palestinian Authority thus far has not produced this bullet.
Now, I want to check on a word there. You describe this as murder. The Israeli government, I think, or at least military, has said, even if it was our bullet, this was in the midst of a crossfire, in effect, with the Palestinians they were pursuing there. Do you view this as murder from the outset, or is that something you think still needs to be determined?
If I use the word murder, I would want to retract that.
Okay.
It was clearly a killing. I mean, when I think of murder, I think of an intentional killing of an individual. And almost no one thinks this was intentional. If it was done by the Israelis, it certainly hasn't benefited them. I mean, Shireen Abu Akleh was a very popular journalist in the Palestinian and wider Arab world. Her killing has inflamed passions in that world. So in no way can this be seen as advancing Israeli interests. So, yes, I would not want to use the word murder. If I did it earlier, I would take that back.
And then there's been some, I think, criticism of media coverage of this being less present than in the killing, and I think in this case clearly murder, of Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi embassy in Turkey. Do you want to can you compare and contrast kind of how we've reacted to those two different deaths?
Well, our reaction was much stronger with the murder, and that's the word I would use deliberately, with Khashoggi. American intelligence agencies investigated Khashoggi's murder and concluded that it was a deliberate act that was ordered by the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman. So here you have a head of state ordering the killing of a Saudi journalist who happened to work for the Washington Post and lived in Virginia. I don't know anyone serious, again, who argues, who would argue that the Israeli Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, told the Israeli security forces to murder Shireen Abu Akleh. I mean, if it did happen, it was a horrible accident. It doesn't excuse it. It needs to be investigated and people have to be punished, if indeed that was the case. But it was a very different situation than what occurred with Khashoggi.
We're talking about U.S.-Israel relations and the killing of journalist Shireen Abu Akleh with Stephen David, international relations professor at Johns Hopkins University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What level of relations should the U.S. have with Israel? What level of support should the U.S. have for Israel? Do you think we are at the right level now? More support? Want to see less? What questions do you have about U.S. interests in the Middle East, in Israel in particular? Coming up also, we'll get into Iran and other Middle Eastern issues. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Stephen David, professor of international relations at Johns Hopkins University, with us today looking at U.S.-Israel relations after the killing of journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions about the U.S. role in Israel and the wider Middle East. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Stephen, after the incident at the funeral, Wisconsin's Democratic Congressman Mark Pocan, generally seen as being on the progressive wing of the party, tweeted, quote, restrictions on aid may be necessary if human rights and universally accepted norms can't be followed in, end quote, in Israel and Palestine. Do you see that being something taken seriously in Congress, making aid to Israel contingent on the results of something like an investigation here into this death?
No. The progressive wing of the Democratic Party, especially the more extreme elements, have always been very hostile towards Israel, but I don't think they speak for the moderate Democrats and certainly not for the Republicans. So I don't see this incident in particular as seriously jeopardizing Israeli American assistance to Israel. Now, if over a long period of time, Israel shows disregard for Palestinian rights, that may change, and we're seeing some erosion of American support for Israel, but it'll take more than this incident to transform that.
This is all going on in the midst of sort of stop and start efforts to renegotiate or change or something the nuclear deal with Iran, canceled under the Trump administration. Israel, part of the story there, of course, very big concerns over Iran getting a nuclear weapon. Can you talk about that part of our diplomacy with Israel?
Sure. Very big and very important question. Just a little background. I mean, the United States and other countries in the UN Security Council plus Germany concluded a deal with Iran in 2015, whereby America and other countries would ease economic sanctions on Iran in exchange for Iran pulling back on its development of nuclear weapons. The United States under President Trump left that deal. President Biden campaigned on an effort to reconstitute it. But there are many questions as to whether the deal, in fact, can be reconstituted, not least of which is the fact that one of the prime signatories and guarantors of the deal is Russia. And American relations with Russia right now are not very strong. And developing a deal that is predicated on Russian cooperation is going to raise a lot of objections. Beyond that, there are concerns about the deal. Its so-called sunset provisions, where in a few years, Iran will be able to move much more quickly towards developing nuclear fuel necessary for nuclear weapons. There are concerns about inspection procedures and so forth. So whether or not the deal goes forward is very much in the air. I should mention the deal is not a treaty. It does not require two-thirds of the Senate for approval. Nevertheless, President Biden is going to face strong headwinds if he tries to conclude this deal.
One long-term trend that seemed to be going on was some of the Sunni-led Arab nations in Israel's neighborhood started to seem like they were more worried about Iran than about the Israel-Palestinian question, more willing to work with Israel, whether directly or more indirectly. Am I right about that? Is that something that was happening? B, do you see that continuing?
Yes, I think you're right on both scores. A number of countries, Arab Gulf states, most prominent among them, have seen Iran as a much greater threat than Israel. And I think that's a proper way of seeing things. For all their anger at Israel and all their concern about the Palestinians, I think the concern about the Palestinians is not that great. What they're most worried about is Iranian expansion. Israel is not seeking to expand into Saudi Arabia or take over Bahrain or the United Arab Emirates, but Iran might be. So the greater threat is Iran. You know, international relations 101 is the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So Israel being an enemy of Iran has become the friend of many of these countries, some of which have recognized Israel formally. So you have a different bloc in the Middle East now. It's not Israel versus the Arab countries and Iran. It's Israel and many of the Sunni Arab countries seeking to counter Iran. This is a sea change in Middle East relations.
And we saw under the Trump administration what they called, I believe, the Abraham Accords, formalizing some of those relationships between Israel and some of the countries we're talking about here. Was that an advance on behalf of the U.S.? Did we help bring countries together, or was that kind of a recognition of things that were already happening?
Well, I mean, yes, it was an advance. I'm not a big fan of Trump or the Trump administration, but even a stop clock gets things right a couple of times a day. The Abraham Accords built upon existing concerns that many of the Arab countries had with Iran, but certainly facilitated these diplomatic recognitions of Israel that have spread throughout a good part of the Arab world. And Saudi Arabia, which has not formally recognized Israel, almost certainly supported the Abraham Accords, or else countries like Bahrain, United Arab Emirates would not have followed suit. So the notion that Israel is not isolated the way it was, hopefully, in some eyes, would give it motivation to be perhaps more forthcoming with the Palestinians, although others fear that the counter-narrative is that Israel will say, hey, we can get what we want without making peace with the Palestinians, so why make greater efforts to try?
Talking to Stephen David from Johns Hopkins University, looking at Israel and the Middle East after the killing of journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Stephen, long-term, you've written about and I think are still thinking and writing about potential existential threats to Israel. What you just said about relations with Sunni nations makes it sound like the threat might be somewhat reduced. What kind of things are you looking at?
Well, I'm looking at external threats to Israel as a Jewish democracy. And the most obvious existential threat is from Iran. If Iran gets nuclear weapons, Israel's future existence is very much at stake. But there are also internal drivers that can remove Israel as a Jewish state or as a democracy from within Israel. There are groups in Israel that wouldn't mind if Israel stopped being a democracy so long as its Jewish identity can be affirmed. Similarly, although less powerful, there are groups on the left who would mind sacrificing Israel's Jewish identity so long as its democratic character could be preserved. But for many of us, certainly I think in the American Jewish community, we see Israel as its essence being both Jewish and democratic. And if either of those characteristics is undermined, Israel as we know it will have disappeared. And that's a major concern.
Now, getting back to our starting point in the killing of journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, what are you watching for next when it comes to the investigations, the response from the international community, and how it could play into those, you know, the escalating tensions we were talking about earlier?
Well, I'm looking for several questions to be answered. First, I want to know who fired the bullet and what investigation is being undertaken to determine who fired the bullet. I'm looking to see the bullet itself. Will the Palestinians turn it over to an international authority for investigation to make that determination? I want to see an Israeli investigation of their behavior at the funeral of Shireen Abu Akleh. Why were the security forces so violent in their confronting of the mourners? I mean, all these questions need to be asked moving forward. And certainly, again, looking at the optics of the situation, Israel has a lot to answer for. And I suggest that they do so quickly. And I speak as a friend of Israel.
And briefly, why this escalation of tensions now over the last couple of months?
Well, I think there was growing frustration, certainly on the Palestinian side, with the status quo. I mean, the occupied territories, again, have been under Israeli control since 1967. For many of us, the only real solution to this conflict are two states, a Palestinian state and a Jewish state. That seems less and less likely. And you have several generations of Palestinians who have lived under Israeli occupation. And again, there's a growing sense that maybe they're never going to get their own state. And I should say this is not just the fault of Israel. It's partially the fault of Israel, but the Palestinian leadership has been no better and has consistently rejected what I think were reasonable and generous offers to at least put the Palestinians on the path to statehood. This refusal on the Palestinian part to accept less than they demand, to take a half a loaf rather than nothing, has left the Palestinians in a horribly dire situation.
Stephen, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Stephen David from Johns Hopkins University with us today, looking at the response to the killing of journalist Shireen Abu Akleh and the current status of U.S.-Israel relations. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, the head of Wisconsin's tourism department joins the show with a look ahead at great summertime travel in the state. You could share your favorites tomorrow on The Morning Show. Some good news from Earth's orbit, good for me anyway. I managed to see the lunar eclipse last night. I've mentioned in the past that usually when something cool happens in the night sky, it's going to be cloudy wherever I am, so I don't see it. One of my main suggestions for amateur stargazers is be sure that you're far away from me if something interesting is happening. For some reason, I have good luck with lunar eclipses. That's the one where the moon goes through Earth's shadow, blocking the sunlight. This is my third one in the last bunch of years. I don't remember exactly how long ago. I know the last one was in the middle of winter. It was really cold, so I kept going outside and looking, then going inside to lay down on the radiator for a while to warm back up. I know lunar eclipses aren't as spectacular as solar eclipses, but I still like them because, like, we're standing on a planet, and all of a sudden we can see that planet's shadow. It's pretty wild. Space news you can use. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out how to know if it's time to get that second COVID booster. Now some weather talk. Is it just me or has it been windier lately? On the one hand, I feel like, yeah, it is. I've had to move the garbage and recycling bins out of the wind more often. I feel like I'm getting hit with the wind more driving on highways. On the other hand, I'm just one subjective human observer with absolutely no data to back this up. So we called a meteorologist for a look at the wind, plus other weather stuff like some record-breaking heat last week. Tim Halbach is a warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service Milwaukee. Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, wind, Tim, according to Rob's garbage bin indicator measure, there have been more windy days this last year than in the past. Is that happening or is this just me?
It's you and all of Wisconsin that their garbage cans have reported to all of us. It's been a very active pattern from basically April through early May, where it seems like we've just had weather system after weather system that's come through. And even though some of them haven't been that strong, there have been some really strong low pressure systems that have caused some extended periods of severe weather to ourselves. If you look, you know, anywhere from, you know, down by the Gulf, they've been dealing with tornado outbreaks and severe weather. And it's because of these large low pressure systems that have been coming through. And it seems like it's been very active this year. So we have looked at some of the data, and on average, it is trending a little bit higher than what we've had in the past during this time of year. Not record-breaking by any means, sure. And we haven't had too many in the way of wind advisory type situations, but definitely on the whole, it's been a very active low-pressure system type windy scenario we've been in.
Over time, do we see more concerns about a heavy wind, straight line winds? Like, I don't think I knew the word derecho like 5 years ago, and now we've had a couple of those over the last couple of years in Wisconsin. Those heavy straight line winds that can be really damaging. They're not tornadoes, but they can really do a lot of damage. Are we just learning that word now in the non-meteorological community?
Yeah, it's basically kind of the same vein as the polar vortex, where it's something that meteorologists have used to describe different weather patterns and scenarios. The derecho is a technical term for a squall line that lasts for a very long time. So it has to meet certain criteria where there's storm reports over a certain mileage. I think it's somewhere over 200 some miles that a storm like that has to go. So we typically get about one or two of those a year. And, you know, there's things that we typically get most of our severe weather from here in Wisconsin. It might not be at that high end type level, but we've had some big ones. May 1998 is kind of the standard for Wisconsin outside of also the Northwoods blowdown a few years ago. Mm-hmm. But in terms of, you know, straight line downburst type winds, it's the most common type of severe weather that we get here in Wisconsin.
And before we move on from my obsession with wind today, Tim, what makes the wind blow? It sounds kind of poetic, but what is it? You mentioned pressure. Is it all about pressure differentials?
Yeah, pressure. You know, we look at where high pressure systems and low pressure systems set up. And if you're right underneath the middle of a big high pressure system, we call that a big bubble, no trouble type days. There's not a big gradient to the pressure that we have there. So if we had a lot more of those days, you'd be maybe talking about how there hasn't been a whole lot of wind, but we've either been in between the area of where the high and low pressure systems are, which creates that really tight pressure gradient, which is what leads to a lot of these windy type days. So if you're right in the middle of one of those, then it tends to have less wind. If you're stuck in between, like we have been for the past few months, it tends to be a windier type scenario.
Talking to Tim Halbach from the National Weather Service, Milwaukee. Well, Tim, last week, I think if you asked people about the weather in much of Wisconsin, they weren't going to talk about wind. They're going to talk about the heat. Pretty hot for May. What did we see?
Yeah, we basically started looking at, you know, this long cold pattern that we were in, and we were like, we're going to get like one day of spring here, and then I think we're going to go straight into the summer period. And that's, you know, you talk about where the low and high pressure systems go, the high pressure system got into the southeastern United States, which is a favorable one for us to get that moisture surge and hot air from the south coming up into Wisconsin. And it just kind of got stalled there. So pretty unheard of to have that streak of high temperatures getting into the 90s. I don't think Madison had ever seen 3 or 4 days in a row where you hit 90. So very unique weather pattern that we got in there.
Yeah, were we seeing records broken? I knew coming into it, there was a thought that we would be flirting with high temperature records for those days.
Yeah, we broke quite a few high and low high temperature records, along with, I believe, the streak for Madison was to have 2 days in a row of 90 degree temperatures. We've never had 3 or 4 days in a row, which I believe we had last week. closer to Lake Michigan, with the differential between the lake temperature and land, we had quite a few, quite a strong lake breeze that kicked in. So Milwaukee broke some records too, but it was super early in the morning before the lake breeze could come through and knock it down. So it was technically a record-breaking scenario that we had there.
And now we're headed into Wisconsin's severe weather season. We start to worry about damaging thunderstorms and, of course, tornadoes. What are you watching for this year?
Yeah, I mean, every year is a little bit different for when we get these. Last year, we had some storms come through in the middle of the night, which caused some other issues, you know, just with being prepared for those storms. You know, any year, it kind of we get severe weather here every year. It's a matter of how frequent it is and, you know, how bad it actually is. So it's important to be prepared. It's, if you haven't already, you know, set yourself up for multiple ways to get warnings. This is the time to do it before we actually have more rounds of severe weather. So it's a matter of time till we'll get some. It's just a matter of when and where. So time to get prepared now and be ready for it.
And Tim, before I let you go, I think I saw you're involved in a study of so-called these urban heat islands, including places like Milwaukee. What are you looking at?
Yeah, so we're going to have people driving around Milwaukee with a thermometer and dew point sensor, which will be measuring the heat at three times during the day on a really hot day to kind of map how the urban heat island works. So if there's pockets of Milwaukee that are hotter than other areas, we'll be able to study that and come up with ways to kind of help those areas out for whether or not they need different trees or more trees or just more access to cooling centers and other things like that. So it's kind of a unique thing that's going to happen here this July.
Tim, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Tim Halbach, warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service Milwaukee, with us today to talk about some record heat last week and certain people's perceptions of high wind here in Wisconsin. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about lilies of the valley and family connection.
Lilies of the valley are often considered a beautiful yet high-maintenance plant. For writer Nancy Jorgensen, they will forever connect her to her beloved grandmother, who found virtue in caring for them. Caregiving was deeply rooted in her grandmother. She dreamed of being a nurse, but society had different plans for a woman of her era. Jorgensen reflects on her grandmother's devotion to her family, dreams, and flowers.
It was May 1977 when my grandmother, Nana, led me to her basement, past the black iron cook stove, then the shelves of home-canned beans and beets. I sniffed the stale scent of Wisconsin wood fires and the mustiness of potatoes in storage, odors familiar to me since childhood. "Come see the lilies," Nana said as she leaned the screen door open and planted one leather shoe into her shady backyard. I was 22 and just married, but Nana's gardens still felt like home. "Bring that shovel," she said. "We'll dig some for your new house." Nana cultivated other species too, phlox, daffodils, violets, pansies. She coaxed each into a vibrant melody until her country yard trilled with color. Every year a new song, but her refrain always lilies of the valley. 4 decades later, Nana's darlings transform my spring landscape from a dirt and grass hoedown to a frothy white minuet. Nana has been gone many years, but her lilies still sing and sway. Nurseries call them a high-maintenance plant, but Nana considered their spreading a virtue. Their duty in life, like hers, to place roots, scatter beauty, and pass gifts on to a new generation. Lilies of the valley thrive in shade. As a woman of the 1920s, so did Nana. Her list of chores, change diapers, weed gardens, wash floors, cast long shadows over each day. Wife and mother was not her first choice of vocation. Many years earlier, she dreamed of an education and a life devoted to healing. "I always wanted to be a nurse," she said. Instead, she lived like neighboring farm wives in her husband's shadow, reflecting warmth and light toward him. Like Nana, lilies of the valley rise early and bloom in the dawn of summer. Slender columns strut low to the ground, each boasting up to a dozen tiny flowers, pure white, only millimeters across. Of all Nana's flowers, I wonder why these captivated her the most. Was it their delicate bell shape, with round shoulders, fat waist, and frilly lip? or their heady scent spicy and persistent? Or was it because they required no harvest, existing only to be lovely? Lilies of the Valley symbolize rebirth, purity, youth, and happiness. But Nana delivered them to the grave of her son, a sailor in the U.S. Navy, and later her husband, who died at only 59, and then another son, whose heart suddenly gave out. In life's valleys, her lilies intoned a requiem. My 30-something daughters inherited Nana's love of gardening. Gwen, a professional athlete, sows kale, plants parsley, and nurtures her bed of mint. Elizabeth buys seedlings from her high school students who grow them in biology. For my daughters, planting is play. The stakes are low. If their gardens produce, they make a caprese salad or add chives to lettuce from the farmer's market. They have none of Nana's worries about climate's uncontrollables like rain, sun, drought, cold, or heat that could result in hungry children. Two generations on either side of me, relishing the wonder of a seed, the beauty in a bloom, the gratification of growing. In 1921, a necessity. In 2021, an amusement. Nana's gardens became her vocation. She buried regrets and tended her plants as she would have tended patients. My daughters garden at their leisure, free to pursue their callings, teacher and writer, professional athlete, or nurse if they so choose.
Writer Nancy Jorgensen brought us that story about her fondness for lilies of the valley. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, an epidemiologist tells us why only 11% of Americans 50 and over have gotten their second COVID booster so far, and how to know if it's time to get yours. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. The FDA approved a second COVID booster shot for immunocompromised people and people 50 and older back in March. But only 11% of people age 50 and older have gotten that second booster so far. How do we know if we're eligible? How do we make the decision of if and when to get a second booster? Ajay Sethi is an associate professor and director of the Masters of Public Health program at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Ajay, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob.
Let's start with that recommendation from the FDA. Why are they saying, hey, people 50 and over, people who are immunocompromised, if you've already gotten that first booster, go get that second one?
Yeah, so this second booster is really designed and meant to prevent people from getting severe illness, not preventing from preventing infection. And people who are 50 and older, are about a third of them, are likely to have significant comorbidities, putting them at risk for severe illness if they were to get COVID. So the recommendation is for anybody over 50, especially somebody over 60 or 65, who is at risk for severe illness. A second booster will really help them.
And why have we seen relatively few people who are eligible based on that age get that second booster shot?
You know, accurate or not, many people probably see themselves as being relatively healthy and then weigh their decisions accordingly. And I would say that it's important to talk to your doctor to see if you are at risk for severe illness. There are lots of conditions that might put you at greater risk. So having diabetes, obesity, cancer, chronic kidney disease, even mental health disorders and some disabilities, cardiovascular disease. Those are all things that can put you at risk for severe COVID if you were to get infected. And of course, if you're immunocompromised, you should definitely get another booster. And that lower age is actually 12. People who are 12 and older should be getting another shot.
If they're immunocompromised.
Yeah, moderately or severely immunocompromised.
I've seen some people talking about, the timing. Maybe somebody wants that second booster shot, but, can they kind of time it so that it's, maybe we'll see another outbreak in the fall. So maybe get in August or something like that. Is there anything to trying to play the timing game with this?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are doing that. And, it's one of those things where as soon as you get infected and you mistimed whether to get a booster, you might regret it. But again, remember that these second shots, second boosters, are meant to prevent severe disease, not infection. So if you get the second booster, you could very well get infected. The vaccines aren't going to prevent that, particularly with the new BA2 subvariant that's circulating. It can still infect you, but you can avoid severe disease. And I think, you know, perhaps when cases get even higher than they already are, people may benefit more. Or if you're about to go to a gathering or visit, you know, family members who are more vulnerable, I'm sure people are doing that timing. But it's better to get it, or at least talk to your doctor about getting it if you think you are indicated.
Now, of course, at the opposite end of the spectrum, Ajay, there is still a significant chunk of the U.S. population who has had zero of the COVID vaccine so far. For someone who hasn't gotten the vaccine, especially someone who hasn't had COVID at all, they've got no protection there. How big a difference is getting that first round of shots going to make for them?
It's really important, simply because when you look at the characteristics of people who are hospitalized with COVID, having severe illness, they're largely people who are unvaccinated, or they may have even had COVID before but not have been vaccinated. If you had COVID previously with one of the earlier variants, that kind of immunity is just not going to last this long to protect you against what's circulating now. So someone who's unvaccinated, someone who's immunocompromised and therefore under-vaccinated also at high risk for hospitalization or worse.
With timing of boosters now, back to boosters, what are the time recommendations for getting that first booster? How long do you have to wait after your first round? And then between the first and second booster?
Yeah, so the antibodies begin to wane 4 to 6 months after the first booster. So the CDC recommends after 4 months of completing the primary series, you know, get and the second booster, first booster, get the second one. For the first booster, that will depend on which vaccine you got to begin with. And for example, if you got the Johnson & Johnson shot, single dose, getting a booster sooner is better. And then eventually you really do want to get the RNA vaccines and not another J&J shot. So it's important to not make it too soon and to wait at least a few months to be able to get that booster.
Now, looking toward the future, Ajay, is there talk, are there efforts to update the vaccines to keep up with the current profile of variants of the virus that causes COVID-19?
Yeah, there are efforts to develop an updated vaccine specifically for Omicron that there's talk about it being available this fall. But, you know, and this is probably factoring into the decision people are making regarding getting that second booster. They might see themselves as generally healthy and they can wait for that Omicron-specific vaccine. I'd say that until the data are available and the manufacturers are ready to produce that, let's not assume it's going to be ready by the fall, but that's the aim. I say that because, you know, we've been talking about getting vaccines out to children under 5 and it keeps getting delayed. So it's best just to decide if right now you're indicated for a booster to get it, if it's going to benefit you, preventing you from getting severe disease.
Talking to Ajay Sethi from UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at COVID vaccine boosters, when you can get that second booster if you've gotten the first one. Ajay, turning to wider trends, and we had a lot of downward trends in case numbers, deaths down to a lower level than they have been in quite a long time. Starting to see, it seems like, some warning signs that numbers are starting to pick up around the country. What are you watching there?
Yeah, transmission is picking up. There are more counties in Wisconsin that are at that sort of medium community level that the CDC gives us as far as a metric of the situation going on here. Wearing a mask indoors is now going to become more important as community transmission continues to increase. Around the country, the northeast of the U.S. has been increasing in cases and now hospitalizations. For a little while, and we're following that. We should expect a continued increase in cases in Wisconsin. Hospitalizations also have been increasing, and hopefully it won't get too high.
You mentioned masks. Now, mask mandates are off the table in Wisconsin, but I'm guessing people ask you from time to time, Ajay, you know, when and where should I wear a mask now? What do you say to people?
Well, if they're asking me that question while indoors, I'll already be wearing one, so I'll demonstrate the importance of that. I'm wearing a mask indoors whenever I can, and you know, definitely in public places. occasionally taking it off if I have to, especially when I'm eating. But it's really important that people are aware that there's a lot of transmission going on now. The newer variant, subvariant of BA2 is more infectious. And if we calibrated our behaviors to sort of earlier variants, thinking, you know, we weren't wearing masks and we got away with not being infected, those calculations are different today. The virus is more infectious. It's always been airborne. It lingers in the air, and it's just important to wear a mask indoors when you can.
Ajay, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Ajay Sethi is an associate professor and director of the Masters of Public Health program at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us for a look at COVID booster shots. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, libraries around the state are using federal relief money to provide unique services in their communities. We'll find out what's going on, and we'll invite you to give a shout out to your own local library. Plus, a look at possible changes to voting in Wisconsin, maybe in the works. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.